Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my privilege to be presenting three authors who will be providing us with a different perspective on the O.J. Simpson case. First of all, we have Stephen Wirth, along with Carl Jaspers, the author of Blood Oath, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. We also have Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception. Oh, by the way, Blood Oath was published in softcover by Rainbow Books, copyrighted 1996. Again, we have Stephen Singular, the author of, among other titles, Legacy of Deception, about the O.J. Simpson case, published in softcover by Dove and copyrighted 1995. And we also have Donald Freed, the author of many titles, and along with Raymond Briggs, the co-author of Killing Time, subtitled The Full Investigation. Gentlemen, welcome once again to our airwaves.
It's always a pleasure.
Good evening.
Now, there are a couple of things that I wanted to discuss about the O.J. Simpson case, so perhaps I can inject those at the end of the discussion, and some of your observations concerning the civil case can start off. This will be sort of a free-form discussion. I wondered what your reactions were to O.J. Simpson's testimony on this past Friday, and also to the media portrayal of that.
This is Steve Singer. I'd like to hear Donald talk about it. He's a lot closer to the action than I am, certainly now. From my understanding, he's spent some time with the Bakers. And can you give us your update?
Yes. First of all, gentlemen, let me greet you on this week of a media storm, a kind of a new scoundrel time, not seen for some years. But in this period, when the media seems to have gone off the rails, whether it be the hapless officer Jewel in Atlanta or the CIA Contra cocaine connection, which brought the director of Central Intelligence to no other place on earth but Watts, California, to face an angry crowd, or to Santa Monica, California, where there is a kind of lynching in the air. And I was in Santa Monica, and I was speaking on television, but I was observing. And I may say that the furore and the frenzy is such that no less than three columnists in the Los Angeles Times took note of what Howard Rosenberg, the media critic, called a second rush to judgment. Howard Rosenberg, Bill Boyarsky, and Peter T. King all set out on Saturday and Sunday in their columns to strike a cautionary note about the kind of minute-by-minute tracking that was going on by MSNBC and other media conglomerates. Tents and technicians dotted the landscape. A crowd was forming. Black clouds moved overhead. Rain fell intermittently. Klieg lights fizzed and smoked in the rain. It was an eerie, unnatural, and almost surreal scene. There were shouts, there were jeers, there were cheers. Vincent Bugliosi was driven from the greensward into a trailer by a part of an angry mob. It was Americana, such as not seen in a long time, while relays of reporters and lawyers from all over the country scuffled in and out from the audio room where the press listens to the trial, the overflow from the handful of seats available within the courtroom to accommodate the world press and that small number of local citizens, some of whom had been waiting since 4 a.m. in the morning, in the rain, to get into the what is now becoming a kind of killing zone. And lawyers would rush saying, Simpson's in trouble. He's in trouble. He clenched his fist. He swallowed. He breathed heavily. He sat back in his chair. And each element of the syntax, of body language, of rhetoric, of answers, was treated like a bullfight or a boxing match, except that you only heard the blows that were landed against Simpson. It was a scene of such terror and pity that eventually a young woman on court TV exclaimed that Simpson seemed vulnerable. He was at bay. Not that he was confused and not that anyone had forced him to lose his demeanor whatsoever. But nevertheless, the intensity was such. It seemed to be symbolized by the Goldmans, father and daughter, who leaned over the rail, staring in implacable vengeance at Simpson. And so it went throughout the day, with more promised for next week. Something that would have been familiar in the 1920s or the 1930s, not since the Lindbergh trial, has there been such atavism and such savagery. And so it went, with the assumption never identified that each increment of reportage was based on the assumption that Simpson was guilty, that he'd gotten away with murder, that he'd been pardoned by a jury too black and too stupid, or both, to take accountability or responsibility for justice in the criminal case, and that now it was a time for vengeance. Now it would be payback time the other way. Now Geraldo Rivera and the chorus of disapproval, the packs of the media, their day in court had come. This was no longer about Simpson, but it was about the media, which and the pundits and the professors and the experts who had been humiliated by predicting the wrong outcome in the criminal case. And there it was. And as a historian, and I'll end on this note, I said on MSNBC, though much of it was cut for the East Coast, I have to tell you, I said, this is November 22nd, 1996, right, a day that should remind us that it is quite possible for a human being to be turned into a monster. This is 1965 in terms of the Kennedy assassination, and Lee Harvey Oswald has yet to be vindicated by history. And I said that just as Officer Jewell in Atlanta was forced to fit the psychological profile until his timeline saved him and returned his mother's Tupperware to her, so O.J. Simpson was now forced into the psychological profile of the battering, beating husband who must become the murderer. And I said to Mr. Gibson, I see that you turn pale when I dare to suggest that perhaps, after all, Simpson doesn't fit that profile any more than Richard Jewell fit the Mad Bomber profile. And that was about the end of my time. And I give you that now for your reaction.
Donald, before we get the reactions from the two Stevens, I wanted to read into the record a short section of Stephen Worth's book, Blood Oath, because I think it is in apposition to what you just said, and will shed a little bit of light and also some
good
foundation for further discussion. In Chapter 5 of Blood Oath, by Stephen Worth and Carl Jaspers, in Skinner's story, the plan Skinner, the code name for the informant who spurred this book, and this individual maintains that he was part of the actual strike team that killed Nicole and Ron, a part of a white supremacist underground group called CAUSE, Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers. In Chapter 5, we read, the plan for the anniversary celebration, that of the murder of Alan Berg, written about so effectively by Stephen Singular, the plan for the anniversary celebration consisted of a plot so sinister, so creative, so diabolical, that the outcome would provide for the embarrassment of an entire city, an entire race, and an entire nation. The plot included a well-thought-out action that would damage the U.S. judicial system forever. It would create a sense of doubt that would exist in every future trial. When we had all gathered in the farmhouse's spacious parlor, the Discoverer, that's one of the code name for another member of the team, the Discoverer continued to explain the rationale of the plan. Quote, evidence presented and testimony offered by law enforcement officers will be challenged forever from this case forward, unquote, he said. Still quoting, it's a plan designed in part to be a payback for all those responsible for actions that had been carried out against freedom-loving white supremacists, unquote. Another founder of the cause picked up the explanation, quote, "The plan is centered around an individual easily recognized and respected among both blacks and whites. It will look like he's being framed by the authorities. The situation's designed to call upon and challenge interpersonal beliefs that every person holds. People will choose sides. Their consciences won't permit otherwise. The final coup will occur when our target is found guilty or his credibility is destroyed. This event will generate instant racial tension followed by violence. We're going to ensure that by fueling what will already be an inflamed situation. The plan will use the distrust between the authorities and the blacks that's existed in Los Angeles for years. At first, everyone will choose up sides. As the discussions become heated and clouded with rhetoric, violence will follow. After much destruction has occurred, the cause will then step forward to take credit for the framing. But it will be painfully obvious that we couldn't have done it without the help of an easily duped, overzealous prosecution." That, by the way, by way of not only serving in opposition to your very eloquent remarks, Donald, but to also to perhaps set the stage for some of the future discussion. The two Stevens, what reactions do you have to what took place on Friday and to what Donald had to say?
Well, this is Stephen Worth, and what I'd like to add is basically what's been coming out of this trial, and unfortunately because Judge Fujisaki decided not to televise it, you're getting sound bites from the media. Nobody has made mention of the 23 unidentifiable
mm-hmm.
footprints
mm-hmm.
that Bosniak has talked about.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of got lost. Nobody's talked about the cut on the right thumb of the right hand, on the glove. That's the right-hand glove.
Stephen Worth, what are these 23 footprints? Because I haven't seen any coverage of those in the media.
Well, it happens to be reported out of the trial. Now, I'm waiting. I've downloaded as much as I can as it comes down onto the Internet and been reading the testimony. There is a cut on the right-hand glove of... In fact, that came out of the testimony of the glove specialist, Ruben, who he had the glove in his hand because everybody would always kind of dodge around it. I don't remember if it was a cut or not a cut. They said, would you examine it? And there's a cut on near the right thumb. Very difficult for a right-handed person to cut your right thumb. Then on the back of it, which is even more unusual, you've got cut marks on the raised blading. Now, again, that suggests that the right hand was across the front of somebody, and somebody with a knife in their left hand did it. So, but you haven't heard anything about that. I mean, that you would think that would be instant reporting because there's something newsworthy, because that's brand new information, never appeared out there. But what's to me even more distressing, and more to following what Blood Oath is about, because it's more than just about the O.J. Simpson case. You were the first to inform me that you had heard through somebody who I checked with and verified today that Metzger, the same guy who is in our book, the same guy that was supposedly linked to the attempted bombing and burning of the first AME church, is now recommending to his people, to other people. As a matter of fact, he'll autograph my book. Anybody who orders it. He's recommended two books, my book and the one by Carl Rowan, The Coming Race War in America.
Carl Rowan, a nationally syndicated columnist, by the way.
That's right. And, you know, Carl Rowan's book talks about Turner Diaries and a lot of these militia groups.
And he's also, by the way, Carl Rowan is also black.
That's right. Apparently, I think this starts to support what the information was provided to us. And as I've said many times, all of the information that we received via Skinner, all right, we believe there's a good deal of it. It's kind of like an enigma. It has different meanings. I mean, the blood planting, the way they said it, could have come through since they talk about Colby
being the provider, and Colby could stand for three things. The person that we've isolated as a fellow by McColburn, a DNA specialist. Colby, who was in, out of the CIA, which is the next door, was the next door neighbor on Gretna Green of Nicole, or Colby, which is the location of the LAPD headquarters where Mark Furman came out of.
Steppenworth, we should note for legal purposes that Tom Metzger denies any involvement in the attempt on the first AME church, although he does admit being in touch with the Fourth Reich skinheads. Go ahead.
Right. Well, it's, what I'm going by is what's in newspaper articles
right.
that talked about him. Now, well, there's no definite link. I'm just curious to why he's now recommending my book. I mean, it doesn't make much sense other than they like publicity.
Well,
and that's written about in Turner Diaries also.
It's also written about in the passage from your book that I just read. They said, one of the questions I've always had about your book is whether perhaps this may have been exactly what Cause is described as going to do. In other words, at a certain point, getting the word out, although I also hold open the possibility that it's exactly also what Skinner said. I mean, I cannot make a definite decision, but I wonder.
Well, it's, I'd like to hear from Stephen Singler what his take on what he's heard about the trial and his take on, Donald has said and what I've said.
Well, two things. First of all, as I've watched this, and it has occurred to me that I think we've moved into an arena where we're analyzing an event that never happened. At least, of course, two people were killed here, and I don't mean to make light of that. But I'm just having great difficulty getting past that. I mean, when I watch the level of analysis, the amount of time and energy and media that is devoted to this, that's what I am, from my own personal opinion, that's what I believe. I believe that people are essentially analyzing an event that never took place, which throws this into a whole other category, which perhaps Donald and David are better equipped to analyze than I am. Number two, at the risk of being exceedingly politically incorrect, I don't think we have any concept of what went on between Nicole Simpson and O.J. Simpson. And if some people may see this male-female thing as black and white, but I'm not one of them. And I don't know what went on between these two people. I don't know who hit whom or when or where. But I am willing to believe, I do definitely, profoundly believe that it is not the black and white situation that people have made it out to be. And that's not an excuse for domestic violence or anything else. We simply don't know what happened. We have facts and absolutely no truth. And those are the two things that have been on my mind lately. I don't know how the rest of you feel about them.
Stephen Singler, you noted in Legacy of Deception the seemingly impenetrable, this is something perhaps we can come back to later, the impenetrable media wall surrounding this case. You were not only actually part of the case in the sense that your book proposal actually became part of the criminal case, but also you attempted to go to various media sources. You were contacted by an anonymous informant within the L.A. legal system because of your work on the Allenberg murder, which Stephen Worth's anonymous informant says was the anniversary celebration of that was one of the motivations for this.
Right.
It's astounding to me to see the way the media is covering it. The San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, November 9th of 1996 carried some information about Werner Spitz, who was testifying concerning the forensics for the plaintiffs. Werner Spitz, by the way, was also involved with the House Select Committee on Assassinations forensic evaluation of the Kennedy assassination, as was Michael Bodden. Perhaps we should remember in that regard, the intelligence community has an old saying that give us the coroner, we'll control the city. One of the things I found so remarkable is that basically Spitz, as reported in, among other papers, the Chronicle of 11-9-96, was saying that the wounds on O.J. Simpson's hands were made by Nicole's fingernails. Yet, as I recall, the analysis of the tissue and blood under Nicole's fingernails indicated it wasn't O.J.'s.
Right.
That's correct.
Well, there was blood that was not O.J.'s. There were, in addition to those 23 footprints, there were also 17 sets of fingerprints at the crime scene that were never identified either.
But the point is that the blood, the material under Nicole's fingernails did not come from O.J. Simpson.
That's correct.
Well, I'll tell you what's of interest. As we kind of look at what's coming out of the civil. I've read 9 days of O.J. Simpson's civil testimony, is actually his deposition. And, you know, the Bruno Magalhães is one of the things that I think Geraldo and the media played to the hilt. And they said, well, now we've got him because we've got pictures showing him wearing Bruno Magalhães. And he said he would never own them. Except that's not what he said. He said he would never own those ugly-ass shoes shown in the criminal case. And he wouldn't. And he says they were purplish-green. At the end of it, when they kept asking him again, they said, as of 1994, did you ever own a pair of, or do you know if you ever owned a pair of Bruno Magalhães? And he said no, which clearly says he didn't know whether he owned them, whether he knew it or not. So it's not like a cut and dry thing. What bothers me the most about some of the things, because it's like an electronic lynching that's going on.
It is, Stephen. Remember that this is also an electronic proof, truth-saying situation, so we have to watch our choice of words.
Yeah, well,
It's been publicized enough that that's what O.J. said. I've seen it on the electronic media elsewhere, but we just have to keep that in mind. Please proceed.
Okay. One of the things is you've got an FBI agent paid by the federal government testifying in a civil case.
Right.
It's almost unheard of.
Right.
In order for an FBI agent to testify, he's got to get approval almost up to the director. The case also, and by the way, I'm getting the feeling that the Baker and Blazer, et cetera, are setting this up for an appeal based on it's, you know, they said that, you can't have double jeopardy. But this is like the state retrying its case through the civil case because it's funded in part by taxpayers' funds. The same witnesses are appearing who, if you'll notice during the case, they keep out, did you get paid? Did you send a bill in? And there hasn't been a bill that I know of yet that's been sent in to pay for these people who are on salary with the city of L.A. or the state of California. That's highly unusual. I mean, if you tried a case and said, I'd like the FBI to testify
yes,
for you,
yes,
they won't even talk to you.
Yes.
Stephen Wirth, something that you and Donald Fried both point out is that both Nicole and O.J., we're getting both written and telephone death threats from white supremacist groups. Some of these were apparently delivered, according to your sources, by sympathetic to the cause group, LAPD people. And in the book about Cato Kalin, it's mentioned that the FBI was aware of this and told O.J. And yet, we have heard nothing about this. And in fact, Nicole, as you revealed, Donald Fried, believed she was under surveillance. And actually asked O.J., she was scared because of the threats and her perception that she was under surveillance, which dovetails with what Stephen Wirth was told by Skinner, and that basically she wanted O.J. to come around. Yet we've heard none of this in any of the media discussion that I've seen.
Well, remember, and this picks up where Stephen Singular left off, that you're listening to the plaintiff's case, and you're hearing a bill of attainder against O.J. Simpson. And remember, at exactly this time, before her death, Nicole Simpson was very unwell, and Mr. Simpson was bringing her soup and food and helping to care for her. What we have here is a three-dimensional relationship, as Stephen suggests. And let me get behind the dramatic scene in court, where the lights were lowered, and O.J. Simpson sat in the witness chair in shadows, while behind him and over him loomed a very large photograph of Nicole Simpson, bruised and abraded, taken sometime after the New Year's Eve confrontation of 1989. And the questions, did you ever hit her? Did you strike her? Did you kick her? Did you strangle her? Never, 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 never. That was broadcast around the world to the predictable reaction of, he must have done it. They have proof. There's the photograph. This is complete denial. This is lying of a magnitude that must include murder. Now, let me put it to you logically, gentlemen, and to your listeners. If you have an open mind, never mind the presumption of innocence or any sympathy for O.J. Simpson, but simply the dignity and self-respect of an open mind, Let me tell you what those pictures show. Remember, there's only one set of pictures. There's only one credible incident of physical contact to which O.J. Simpson pled no contest, that is to say, guilty, and took responsibility. And that is New Year's Eve, 1989. Now, what that photograph shows, and the defense may indeed boldly decide to use that photograph for Simpson rather than against him. And here's how that would work. The photograph shows scratches, bruises, abrasions, redness, and some discoloration. And that is consistent with Simpson's statement that they wrestled, he had her in an arm lock, he he held her, he had to push her, he locked her out of the room, all of this as a result of a mutual physical, let us put it neutrally, a physical confrontation. He said again and again and again Friday in court, I take responsibility. I don't know how all the bruises may have occurred after I locked her out. She may have fallen, but it doesn't matter. I take responsibility. He said that over and over and over again. And only if you play that against the statements of never, never, never. Now, does the testimony make sense? Let me conclude in this way. Let me tell you what the photograph does not show. The photograph does not show that O.J. Simpson hit Nicole Simpson. Because if O.J. Simpson had ever hit Nicole Simpson, if any heavyweight athlete, and in this case one of the great world-class athletes of coordination and power and speed, who doesn't have to run anywhere to hit someone, if he's standing next to a smaller, however fierce physically and well-trained Miss Simpson may have been, she was considerably smaller and slighter. And if she was standing within range of O.J. Simpson's arm and fist, you would not be looking at a young woman with scratches and bruises. You would be looking at a smashed face.
One point we should make, Donald, because O.J. Simpson's athletic prowess has come into the arguments that he could have done it because he was such a great athlete. He certainly is still very, very strong, but he's no longer the running back he once was. He's very arthritic, as it came out in the...
That applies to... That's the killing time itself. I'm now talking about 1989. And had he hit her, you would see broken bones. Mm-hmm. You would see wires. You would see prolonged hospitalization.
You know, Donald, there's another...
Stephen Worth, I want to take...